This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt just signed into law the most restrictive state-level anti-abortion bill in the nation. The bill passed the GOP-dominated Oklahoma state legislature with 80% support earlier this month. Oklahoma had become a refuge for people seeking abortions from neighboring Texas, where anti-abortion advocates have found great success. In fact, in Texas, a 26-year-old woman was recently slapped with murder charges in a case of self-induced abortion. Although the state dropped the charges days later, the move had a chilling effect on abortion access. Meanwhile, as reproductive justice advocates expect the Roe v. Wade precedent to be overturned by the conservative-dominated Supreme Court, the Senate just narrowly voted in the nation's first black woman, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. We turn now to Imani Gandhi. She is senior legal analyst for RewireNewsGroup.com, where she covers law and the courts, and she also is the co-host of the podcast Boom Lawyered. Welcome to the program, Imani.
Thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about Oklahoma, which seemed to come out of nowhere. All eyes were on Texas. And then we have this bill that passed the legislature and was signed into law. And it's now supposedly a done deal. I imagine it'll face legal challenges. But what is happening in Oklahoma?
I think Oklahoma is sort of doing what a lot of states, a lot of red states, a lot of states that are hostile to abortion are doing, which is testing the waters, right? Oklahoma wouldn't have passed a total abortion ban if they didn't think that the Supreme Court was ready to reverse Roe. So there are a lot of states that are sort of shooting up these trial balloons. Oklahoma, just a few months ago, I think it was actually the beginning of March, the Oklahoma Senate passed a 30-day abortion ban. So part of it is just them being, I don't want to say that they're gloating, but they know that they have the courts and they're just kind of being ridiculous for the sake of being ridiculous. There's no reason why any state legislature should be passing a 30-day abortion ban. It's absolutely absurd. And now we have, you know, the governor of Oklahoma has signed this total abortion ban. At the same time, another total abortion ban is moving through the House. This one has the SB 8 Texas-style bounty hunter provision attached to it. So and as you said, Oklahoma has become an access point for abortion for patients in Texas. And so now I'm not sure where abortion patients in Texas and in Oklahoma are going to go. Perhaps they'll go to Colorado. Colorado is a good access point. Colorado, which is where I live, we just passed the a reproductive health Protection Act, essentially, that enshrines the right to abortion in the Constitution. So, or at least that specifically states that abortion is a right in Constitution in Colorado. So my dog is excited about this too. So I think what we're seeing right now is just the predictable ramping up of anti-abortion rhetoric, anti-abortion restrictions as we head to the sort of end of Roe. That's coming up any time now, between now and the end of June. I think and then after that, we're going to see states go even more bananas. I expect to see certain states are going to decide to perhaps start special sessions so that they can pass legislation that they weren't able to pass or didn't get around to passing during the regular legislative session. And I think by this time, you know, in the fall, abortion's going to be criminalized in about half of the states. And I think that's a really incredible, scary place to be.
I mean, just sticking to Oklahoma for a minute, if this is to be the model for, you know, what happens nationwide, I understand that basically now all abortions are illegal, even in the case of rape and incest, except there's one exception, which is when the life of the parent in question is in danger, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's really remarkable about the anti-choice movement is the way that it has managed to shift its strategy depending upon their political power and depending upon what polling in the American people want, right? So the American people have not had a very big stomach for criminalizing actual pregnant people, actual pregnant women. And so I think what we're seeing now is anti-choicers beginning to ramp up the level of restrictions to see what is acceptable. It used to be that you had to have a rape exception because it was unacceptable to force a woman or a pregnant person to bear the child of their rapist. And now we're seeing that that there is no longer a rape exception. There is no longer an incest exception because the logic goes, why should the baby be punished for the sins of the father? As if the woman, the pregnant person, is completely irrelevant in the calculus, as if the emotional trauma they're going to suffer is completely irrelevant. So what we're seeing is a movement towards punishing women and pregnant people who get abortions, completely discounting any emotional trauma, any situation that may have led to them needing or wanting an abortion, and just focusing on the sort of innocence of the life that is growing inside the pregnant person, right? Whatever has led the pregnant person to the point where they need an abortion, something has gone wrong in their life, the logic goes. And therefore, we need to turn our attention to this innocent life that this person who has gone wrong in some way is trying to snuff out. This person is already a lost cause, but this potential life could be the next president of the United States. I mean, we would see in the early 2010s billboards that said, you know, things like the most dangerous place for a black child is in the womb, and pretending as if black women were going to be birthing Barack Obama's left and right. So we're seeing a real shift in rhetoric, a shift that is way more anti-woman, way more anti-reproductive freedom, and more focused on propping up these so-called fetal personhood rights.
So there is the situation in Texas, you know, setting aside the laws that have been passed in Texas, the case of this woman, Lizette Herrera, who was charged with murder charges in a self-induced abortion. It's still not clear whether it was she herself who had a miscarriage or she helped somebody. From what I can tell, it's likely she who had a miscarriage. The charges were dropped. And it reminds me of those cases that we had seen a few years ago where women were being criminalized for having miscarriages. And actually, there was a woman in Oklahoma last year that didn't get that much national attention, Brittany Hulaw, a Native American woman who was convicted, not just charged, but convicted of manslaughter after having a miscarriage. Is this going to be the new normal?
Absolutely. And it has been normal for a while. I mean, as you said, Brittany Hulaw, there's Purvi Patel in Indiana, who was sentenced to 41 years in prison because of a bad pregnancy outcome, an outcome that they couldn't even prove was related to the abortion pill she took. So yes, this is going to be the new normal, and we're going to see it's going to hit black and brown women first. Black and brown pregnant people are going to be the ones who are targeted by these laws that criminalize pregnancy. And what's frankly shocking about what happened with Lizelle Herrera in Texas is that there is no law on the books in Texas that permits law enforcement,
right,
or agents of the state of Texas to criminalize pregnant people.
And that's why maybe it was dropped, and maybe now they're going to start the groundwork for putting it in place.
Well, they're absolutely going to do that. But what was interesting about this in this sort of whoopsie daisy grand jury proceeding is that there never was any statutory authority for what happened. So I think they just wanted to see if they could get a grand jury to convict a person of murder after a miscarriage. And they did. They found they were able to do that. And then the DA says, oh, whoops, actually, we don't have any law that allows us to do that. We're not going to press charges. You're not going to press charges because you have nothing to charge her with. But that didn't stop you from going through a grand jury proceeding. And that's not something that a district attorney does lightly. Right. There's a reason that grand jury proceeding took place. And it was to see whether or not American people who would be sitting on grand juries or impaneled on grand juries will have the stomach to convict pregnant people, mothers, parents of crimes of murder because of a miscarriage. I mean, that's where we are. And apparently there are some Texans who do have the stomach for that.
But there are also a lot of Texas advocates for reproductive justice, as there are in every state. What has the pushback in Texas been like? Even though, of course, Oklahoma is now the state with the most restrictive abortion law in place, in Texas, that fight really has taken on a lot of attention because of that bounty hunting law that you mentioned earlier. And it's become ground zero for a lot of the fight around abortion. How are pro-abortion advocates, how are pro-reproductive justice advocates in Texas responding? And is it with them that success can come about?
Well, grassroots activists in Texas, reproductive justice activists in Texas, are truly some of the most heroic people, aside from abortion providers themselves. I mean, they are working under extremely difficult conditions in a state that has decided that they don't have a constitutional right that exists everywhere else in the country. I mean, Roe versus Wade has been functionally reversed since September of last year. And while there are still abortions that are going forward within that 6-week time frame, you know, that is such a short window. So what a lot of activists in Texas are focusing on now is just trying to get money to people who need abortions quickly. And so we have a lot of abortion funds that are working overtime, that are really trying to either get people in Texas abortions or get people out of Texas so that they can get abortions in states like Oklahoma, which has now become an abortion desert as of today. So, you know, and when it comes to activism in Texas, you see that a lot of this activism is being led by Black and brown people. And I truly believe that it is Black and brown people who are best equipped to deal with this sort of community organizing because they know what the communities are like and they know what those communities need. Far too often we'll see mainstream reproductive rights organizations, they'll swoop into these lower income communities or into these communities of color and try to sort of take over the activism, to take over whatever process has been going on. And while they may take it over, they may alienate some of the actual activists on the ground. And then when they leave, they don't leave any infrastructure. So it becomes a problem for activists on the ground who are being swept aside in favor of larger groups who then have to come back in and fill that gap, fill a vacuum that has been left by these mainstream groups. So I have nothing but the utmost respect for grassroots advocates, people like La Frontera, organizations like Jane's Due Process in Texas, abortion funds like T Fund, Lilith Fund, am I forgetting? The AFIA Center. These are all organizations that are working really hard to make sure that vulnerable Texans are able to access abortion, because we have to remember it's not going to be middle and upper class white women who are going to have problems accessing abortion. Just like it's not necessarily not, it's more often than not going to be Black and brown women who are systematically targeted by law enforcement. Yes, there have been white women who have been targeted, but they're not the main sort of, they're not the main demographic, right? They're not the people who are going into a hospital and telling a healthcare worker some private information and then having that healthcare worker go and call the cops. Healthcare workers are calling the cops on Black and brown women. They're not calling the cops on white women. That's just
right.
The way it is. And it's unfortunate that we are now living under this mass surveillance system that, you know, Texas has erected, but that now is popping up all over the country with these bounty hunter provisions. And I've been saying this for a while, that I think it's particularly nefarious that this is going on at a time of economic crisis, right? We're in the middle of a pandemic. There's an economic crisis. There's inflation. Interest rates are going up. I mean, people are struggling financially. And now what we have are states that are sort of capitalizing on people's financial struggle to encourage them to snitch on the private behavior of their neighbors on the off chance that they are going to be able to collect this $10,000 bounty. And, you know, and that's surveillance. That's the mass surveillance of pregnant people in this country. And I think it's horrifying, quite frankly.
Right. And so the wealthy will be able to fly to wherever they want to access abortions. Let's talk about the Supreme Court. And before we get to what is expected to happen, as you mentioned earlier with Roe versus Wade, there is a celebratory moment at hand, which is the confirmation of the Supreme Court's first Black woman justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Even though she will be one of only three liberal justices, you know, arrayed against six conservatives, for you, how significant was this moment? And also, how significant was it that only three Republican senators decided to vote for her?
It's such a significant moment. I mean, I personally am overjoyed about it. I understand that some people are hesitant to be as excited as I think they should be. I think everyone should be extremely excited about this moment, about this cultural moment. And that is because, as you said, there's a 6-3 conservative majority on the court. So her replacing Breyer doesn't do anything to change the ideological makeup of the court. But what is important to remember is that when it comes to court reform, and that's what's going to have to happen. I mean, we're going to need broad court reform in order for any progressive values to ever be able to pass through Congress and then make it through this court ever again. But what we are looking at is the addition of a voice that has been thus far excluded from the court, not just as a Black woman, but also as a public defender. And the fact that she is going to be able to bring that knowledge to bear, to bring the knowledge that she gained while working on the Sentencing Commission and reducing sentences for certain drug-related offenses, a lot of drug-related offenses that are particularly tied to Black communities, the fact that she's going to be in the room and taking part in those arguments is huge. It's enormous. And in addition, while I don't necessarily think she's going to be able to really change any minds when it comes to these big cases that are coming up, there is an opportunity there for growth in terms of the conservative justices. I do believe that there are some conservative justices who may be able to be reached on certain issues. It may not be the big, broad issues that they were essentially installed on the court to decide, but studies do show that when you diversify the bench ethnicity-wise, that white people tend to sort of understand where Black people are coming from a little bit more, right? Forced to face our humanity, exactly. And not even to the extent that they haven't seen Black people as human before, because I don't want to make that broad statement about all conservatives, but I do think that it's safe to say that if you haven't had to talk to people, to have relationships, whether professional or social, with people of different races, then you're not necessarily able to step outside yourself and think about what life might be like for that person. And so the fact that Jackson is going to bring not only her personal knowledge as a professional Black lawyer and all that entails, everything she had to go through to get to the point where she is, but she's also going to be able to bring knowledge to bear about what it's like for criminal defendants who by and large are Black simply because of the racist criminal justice system that we have. And so perhaps she will be able to make some headway when it comes to Fourth Amendment arguments. I mean, these are things that cannot be discounted. And let's say she doesn't change a single mind and everything goes as horribly as possible, and the six conservative justices vote in lockstep on every single issue, they're not going to be in power forever. Republicans are not going to be in power forever. At some point, it may not be in my lifetime, it may not be in Gen Z's lifetime, but at some point, the opinions that Sotomayor and Kagan and Justice Jackson are writing will become majority opinions, because progress is inevitable. I think right now we're in a huge backlash to the progress of having the first Black president, frankly. And I think this backlash is going to last a while. We're moving into territory that I haven't seen in 30 years when we're talking about, you know, lesbians and gays and bisexual people trying to groom children, when we're talking about the ways in which trans people are somehow child predators. This came up in her confirmation, right? They tried to paint her as a child predator. That's part of this backlash, this fear that that they're trying to instill, I think, in white families. I think we're seeing that play out, for example, when it comes to discussions of critical race theory and whether or not certain types of culturally responsive teaching belongs in the classroom. This is about soothing white fears of Blackness, quite frankly. And so I think that Jackson's elevation to the court is scary to a lot of white folks, but there are also a lot of progressive white folks and a lot of people of color who are viewing this as just a momentous moment and as a moment for celebration, a celebration for what the country could be, right? This is a woman who spoke so passionately and patriotically about her love for this country. And the fact that there's a Black woman who can speak that passionately about love for country means that she's the perfect Black woman to be sitting on the Supreme Court right now. She's the perfect person to be writing opinions that will become dissents in the future.
And then finally, Imani, on Roe v. Wade, what role do you think Justice Jackson will have in that debate? And is it inevitable that this is going to be overturned?
Yeah, Roe is going down. I mean, there's no question about that. How much damage the court does to abortion rights is still up for grabs. But as case law, as a constitutional principle, Roe versus Wade is going down because you cannot uphold Mississippi's 15-week ban without reversing Roe. That's just the two are incongruous. You can't do it. But the question remains, what is the court going to do? How is the court going to allow states to regulate abortion going forward? You know, are they going to, for example, say that the undue burden standard, which from Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which says that states can't place an undue burden in the path of people seeking an abortion, whether they're going to expand that undue burden standard to include gestational bans such that state activity in restricting abortion will be used to uphold the abortion restrictions themselves. So what I mean by that is, for example, a state like Mississippi has argued in court that there are no abortion clinics in Mississippi that do abortions past 16 weeks. So it's not that big of a deal. It's not an undue burden for a 15-week abortion to remain on the books. Well, it used to be, back in the day when Roe was still good law, it used to be that no pre-viability ban was constitutional. Therefore, no 15-week abortion ban can be constitutional. In a post-Roe world, we may move to a system where whether or not a 15-week ban is constitutional depends on whether or not it's an undue burden to people seeking that kind of abortion in that state. And if states have been really great about shuttering clinics, which a lot of states have been, then they'll be able to make the argument that, well, a 10-week ban is perfectly constitutional because there are no clinics that do abortions past 10 weeks in this state anyway, so it can't possibly be an undue burden on a person seeking an abortion, right? These are the sorts of legal arguments, the sort of legal shenanigans that are going to go on. And so, yes, Roe is going down. It's still up in the air how many abortion rights will remain. And we are starting to see blue states step up. You know, Gretchen Whitmer is asking the Michigan Supreme Court for an opinion about whether or not their state constitution protects abortion. Vermont has protected abortion. Colorado has protected abortion. California and Washington have already been protected abortion. So, you know, we're going to see a patchwork sort of quilt of laws in this country. And I think that we're going to see about half the states in this country criminalizing abortion. And we're also going to see a ramping up of anti-choice efforts to pass a national abortion ban.
And of course, somehow our Congress could just legislate abortion rights, which they haven't done.
What they're going to do is legislate abortion rights away. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, Democrats slept on codifying Roe and it's too late for that now. Yeah. I mean, it's really too late for that because the ways in which the abortion rights fight is playing out is inherently tied to the ways in which the voting rights fight is playing out, right? People cannot vote in legislators who are going to protect their reproductive rights if those legislators are not permitting them to vote. And that's what's going on in states like Alabama and Georgia, all over the place. There are states that are gerrymandering the black vote into nothing, thereby making it impossible for Democrats, black voters who tend to vote Democrats, to vote in people who will undo some of the damage that these Republican legislatures have done. And, you know, we saw in Virginia, for example, under Governor McAuliffe, that Virginia Democrats were able to undo so many abortion restrictions. But now with the election of Youngkin just a few months ago, all of those abortion restrictions are going to be back. It's just a kind of like a rubber band that's expanding and contracting. And right now we're contracting. The rights will expand eventually, but it's going to take a lot of fighting and a lot of work.
And in the meantime, how many people will suffer who need abortions, who are seeking them, who can't access them, who might lose their lives trying dangerous means to have an abortion, risk arrest, et cetera, et cetera. It's just the human cost is really, we're going to start seeing it, I think, in a really big way very, very soon.
And it's a generational issue as well, because you have to remember that something more than half of women who seek abortions are already mothers. So if we're now going to start throwing these women, these pregnant people in jail, then who's going to take care of their kids? Their kids are going to be, if their kids don't have, you know, a father in the home or another guardian that can take care of them, then they're going to be thrown into the foster care system. And, you know, a federal judge ruled years ago that the Texas foster care system is so bad that kids who age out of it have PTSD rates as at twice the level of combat veterans.
Wow.
So we're just, I mean, it's not, it doesn't stop with the woman or the abortion provider seeking the abortion. It actually trickles down into how the family is formed, who is going to take care of the family, who's going to take care of the existing kids. It's like you said, the human cost is really untold.
Imani, I want to thank you so much, as always, for joining us. Rewirenewsgroup.com is the best place to find your work.
Yes, it is.
Thank you. And we'll link to that from our website. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest has been Imani Gandhi, senior legal analyst for RewireNewsGroup.com, where she covers law and the courts, and she's the co-host of the podcast Boom Lawyered. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.